Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Today is day 18 of the Trump administration. On Friday, a federal judge temporarily blocked the president's executive order that suspended entry of all refugees into the U.S. for 120 days. The same executive order froze entry for Syrian refugees indefinitely, blocked entry for 3 months to residents from Iraq, Syria, Iran, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen. That battle continues to play out in the courts. Dr. Tim Shorn is a professor at the University of South Dakota. He specializes in Middle Eastern politics, international human rights, and international law. Dr. Tim Shorn, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back.
We're hoping you can sort all this out for us. How's that?
Well, I'll certainly try.
I'm overstating it because this is pretty complicated stuff. And we knew this going into the election and we see it playing out now.
It is. And I think, certainly President Trump had promised that he was going to act quickly on a number of issues. But I think the speed and the breadth of what he wanted to address was somewhat surprising to people outside of the White House. And certainly his executive order on immigration was just one of the issues that took a number of people by surprise.
Let's start with that one, though. And how did it resonate as far as Middle Eastern policy went?
Well, I think it to some extent undermined what some of the things that we want to accomplish. One is that we want to prevent civilians from being harmed in the numerous conflicts that are occurring in the Middle East right now. We want to give people an opportunity to escape the influence and the oppression of ISIS, maybe even the Assad regime, sectarian violence in Iraq and elsewhere, the growing war in Yemen. And what this particular executive order did was essentially froze in place any American policies to alleviate suffering and open our borders to those who had a real reasonable concern about their safety and security.
And what does that do?
Well,
to put on hold American policies to alleviate suffering, when you say it like that, that seems like it would have a pretty significant impact.
Well, it does. And one of the things that we have to remember, and this is certainly one of the facets of the executive order that are going to be hashed out in court, was that nobody who was enforcing the executive order was quite clear about how far it was supposed to reach. So what we saw was people who already had visas, already had residency permits to come to the United States were suddenly halted either at foreign airports or American airports. So this called into question the legal processes that they had gone through to acquire the ability to come to the United States. Now, this raises a couple of issues. First, those people who had been working for American companies in the U.S., students who were returning to study, maybe those who had worked with us in Iraq or elsewhere and were in danger, all of a sudden found themselves prevented from coming back to the United States. Also, it undermines the legal processes that everyone had gone through to get here legally. And what it could ultimately do is encourage others to use non-legal methods to come to the United States. They will find out that, in fact, they aren't getting the protections that they expected by following the steps in the legal process.
Hmm. So what was its intention?
Well, I suppose that, and that depends on who you talk to. I mean, certainly one of the intentions is to prevent the United States from being harmed by people who might sneak in through legal processes but have a desire to harm the United States. So I can say that if we want to look at it from the kindest possible perspective, it was about security. But certainly there are actors within the White House who are advising President Trump who would like to slow either migration to the United States or at least the migration of certain populations to the United States. And that is not necessarily in keeping with American values and is certainly not going to enhance security. Also, it could be that there were people in the White House, including President Trump, who simply wanted to demonstrate that they were going to be bold in the first 100 days and they were ready to tackle some of the most important issues facing the United States.
What about this argument that it's okay to take a pause and say this is not a permanent thing? We need to sort some things out policy-wise. There were a lot of people who were saying, yeah, let's look at this. And to do that, we need to stop things and take a deeper look. Is that a realistic way to approach American foreign policy?
Well, it is a reasonable approach as we look long-term at immigration to the United States. I would argue, however, that it's an unreasonable approach toward those who have already acquired the legal documents to come to the United States. They have already been vetted. Many of them had already been here, presented no threat to the United States. And so it could have been, a bit of a broad blast at migration toward the United States, where something slightly more focused would have been more beneficial to American policy in the longer run.
Putting a freeze on Syrian refugees entirely, what's the impact of that going forward?
Well, this raises one of the, I think, critical issues that not only the United States but the international community is going to have to address. I would argue that the international community, by and large, has ignored this successfully, if you will, and that is dealing with people who have escaped the civil war in Syria, find themselves either displaced persons internally or refugees externally. If they have nowhere to go, if they find themselves languishing over the long term in refugee camps that are under-resourced, under-secured, eventually they are going to wonder why they are avoiding extremism and radicalism and why instead they aren't simply embracing it to fight for their own, basic concerns in the future. So my fear is that as we essentially lock Syrian refugees in place where they are now, that we are going to encourage extremism and radicalism, including violence, in the not-so-distant future and certainly for a generation or two to come.
President Donald Trump talked over the weekend about Russia and their role. I think he said Russia helps us in the fight against ISIS. And so let's bring Russia into this conversation as it relates to Syria. And are they helping us in the fight against ISIS is the first question.
Well, I have doubts about that. If Russia is involved against the fight against ISIS, it is for very selfish Russian concerns. A significant number of the foreign fighters who find themselves fighting along ISIS in Iraq and Syria are people from Russia and the former Soviet Union, probably a couple of thousand out of the 15,000 foreign fighters that are present there now, or 12 to 15,000 foreign fighters. Russia wants to ensure that these actors, a significant number of Chechens, perhaps Dagestanis, perhaps others, are destroyed in Iraq and Syria so they don't return home to cause instability and insecurity in the southern rim of Russia. So if Russia is fighting ISIS in Iraq and Syria, it's not to cooperate with the United States. It's not to cooperate with the international community. It's to protect themselves. Additionally, it is to protect one of their clients, and that is the Assad regime, and to ensure that he doesn't fall. They have strategic concerns regarding Syria. They have a naval base. They have an air base. Chances are they will keep those bases for decades to come. And they want to ensure that the Assad regime remains in power so that they can retain that outlet to the Mediterranean, and also then to keep, again, as I mentioned, those ISIS fighters in Iraq and Syria and not returning home.
So what happens if the Assad regime stays in power? What's the impact of that in the Middle East?
We can expect a replay of what we are seeing now, I would argue, in 20 to 25 years, because the Assad regime is not going to simply let bygones be bygones. The Assad regime, through both Bashir and his father Hafez, have a habit of attempting to eradicate any type of opposition, and oftentimes violently. So even if the civil war does come to an end, we can expect that violence is going to continue in Syria, and that violence will result in renewed civil war, probably in 20 years or 30 years.
Are there lessons for the United States regarding, I'm going to jump back to Syrian refugees briefly, are there lessons for the U.S. in how Europe handled the refugee crisis in Syria?
I would argue that it's the United States should have learned a lesson, but it's not a lesson that just deals with how the Europeans addressed Syrian refugees. It's about how the international community addresses refugees. The international community, the United Nations, and the community, the United Nations, is made up of its members, and that includes us. It includes our allies. Everyone was slow off the mark to address the Syrian refugees. We should have seen it coming once the civil war started and it was clear that it wasn't going to end anytime soon. And we were slow to prepare neighboring countries and to assist neighboring countries in the influx that they were going to face. And countries like Turkey, Lebanon, others simply were not going to have the wherewithal to address this themselves. And as those camps became inundated, clearly refugees were going to seek opportunity elsewhere. We should have been on the ground faster and larger. We should have been prepared to address a larger number of refugees with more resources early on. And so this crisis now is one of ours and our allies and others' own making.
Was it possible?
It was.
Do we have a precedent for it?
We have seen the large scale numbers of people crossing borders in Somalia or out of Somalia. We have seen it with Afghanistan. We have seen it with Cambodia. We have seen large numbers of refugees elsewhere. All we have to do, too, is think back to the post-World War II era and the movement of people, millions, tens of millions across borders. We should have been prepared for something like this. We knew it could happen, and we know what it requires to address.
Let's talk about these seven countries: Iraq, Syria, Iran, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, Yemen. These are the countries that have been named by the Trump administration 3 months blocking entry to the U.S. from those countries. Some people have called it a ban on largely Muslim countries. People from the administration say, no, it is not a Muslim ban. When you look at those countries, is there something else they have in common other than a predominantly Muslim population?
Well, as we look at a number of countries, they aren't strategic partners with us, such as we would see with Saudi Arabia or Pakistan or Egypt. And I think that is probably an important point to consider. The countries that I mentioned, at least a couple of them, Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, while being strategic partners, have probably done more to encourage political and religious terrorism than any other countries in the world. So it is somewhat ironic that, one, they are still considered to be rather strategically placed, in many ways, partners, and that they didn't end up on the ban themselves. I think at times when we look at the seven countries listed, it's kind of a shotgun blast. It's who has upset us, where have things gone poorly for American policy, and the countries that are listed have been no greater threat to American security or no greater creator of terrorist violence than some of the countries that aren't on the list. We have a long history with Iran going back to the fall of the Shah and taking the diplomats hostage on through to their support for Hezbollah, the attack on the Marine barracks in Beirut in the early 1980s. All of this comes into play as well. And sometimes it's the process of looking like you are doing something in order to create a psychological feeling of security rather than a real sense of security.
So what kind of conversations, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Tim Shorn. He's a professor at the University of South Dakota, specializing in Middle East policy, international relations. We're talking about this executive order by President Trump and other issues going on in the Middle East today. Dr. Tim Shorn, I'm wondering what kinds of conversations should we be having in America right now as we sort of look at not only the president's executive orders, but some of the other things that we see happening in the Middle East. What sort of dialogue do we need to have to be effective?
I think we need to start thinking about, you know, where are the conflicts occurring right now? Is there a way to de-escalate them? Are there some that are likely to get worse in the future? And where are the potential hotspots in the Middle East? We look at Yemen, for example. In many ways, that was an unnecessary escalating war, oftentimes because of power plays between the Saudis and the Iranians. That's going to create more radicalism, it's going to create more refugees, and it was something that probably could have been localized rather than expanded. We need to consider our future relationship with Iran. Iran, contrary to what we oftentimes hear from political leaders, is not the root of all evil. There are areas where we could work together. And even if the United States decides not to work closely with Iran and not to advance relations with Iran, Europeans and others are going to step in. So it's simply going to be us versus Iran. We need to think about the Iranian political system, that it's oftentimes rather schizophrenic. You have a very conservative, hardcore group versus those who are somewhat more moderate. We need to work to empower the moderates. What's going to happen in Iraq? Is sectarian violence going to slow to where eventually it is somewhat of an anomaly in day-to-day Iraqi politics? Are we working with an Iraqi government that encourages working across sectarian lines, or are we empowering a sectarian government as we did before? These are the types of questions we need to not always think about. What is happening today, we need to think about, where could this possibly go? If we take action A, B, or C, what are the consequences, and is it going to result in something unexpected? We need to start asking more questions.
So the potential impact then of President Trump's warnings against Iran for a ballistic missile test is going in the opposite direction of where what you just described.
I would argue it is, and I am no fan of Iran getting ballistic missile technology, or they probably already have it. To some extent, we don't want them to improve it. That being said, this could very well have been an opportunity seized by the hardliners in Iran to undermine the more moderate forces. I would have advised President Trump to take a lower key response and to work with our allies to make it clear to Iran that we do not appreciate that move, and to empower the more moderate elements in the regime who were successful in getting their government to agree to the nuclear treaty that was negotiated and ratified, if you will. And instead, the bluster coming out of the White House is simply going to encourage then more bluster from the hardliners. So I think a lower key response in a number of these instances would actually achieve greater security for the United States and our allies rather than a hardline response.
And we say bluster, we should give an example, and I'll just read one of Donald Trump's tweets, and he says, "Iran is playing with fire. They don't appreciate how kind, in quotation marks, President Obama was to them. Not me, exclamation point." So that would be sort of a definition of bluster and a less nuanced approach. Is that what I'm...
That's right.
Is that
and
fair?
And I think we have to remember, too, this, you know, as the international community, as our allies and others work with Iran, it's not just us. And so if we put ourselves out at one end of the spectrum of responses to Iran, we can probably expect that we're going to be out there alone, because the Europeans, including Russia, the United Nations Security Council, are fairly pleased with where the recent agreement is going. They are probably displeased with Iran's missile tests, but they're not going to scrap the entire regime in order to respond to Iran's missile program. And if the United States stakes out a certain position, we can expect that we're going to be there alone, and the rest of the world is going to continue to move forward with relations with Iran.
Dr. Tim Shorn, he's also a director of international studies at the University of South Dakota. Dr. Shorn, come back anytime.
It was a pleasure being here. Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to In the Moment. Our perceptions influence the way we see ourselves, others, and the world around us. It's time we understood how and why. Tonight at 6:30 Mountain Time, Halima Yates presents Impacting Perceptions as part of the Black Hills State University Rapid City Speaker Series. Halima Yates joins us now from Rapid City. Halima, welcome to In the Moment.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Let's talk about this word perceptions and sort of define it a little bit. When you say the word perceptions, what are we talking about?
Well, the definition of perceptions is the recognition and interpretation of sensory stimuli based chiefly off of memory. So whatever it is that we're sensing, we're using our memory in order to know how to interpret it. And so that is why I do this, is because the actions we take in life, the choices we make, it all has to stem from the thoughts that we have, the views and the beliefs and the values that we have. And so it's looking into the source of where these perceptions come from to realize if it's having a beneficial or destructive impact in your life.
So give me an example.
Sure. Yeah. So that's even why I even started doing this to begin with. I myself had some damaging self-perceptions of myself. And so I allowed that to hold myself back in order to be living up to my fullest potential. And when I had to step back and self-reflect and see where these views were actually coming from, I was able to heal and be able to move forward. And so I want to be a part of doing anything I can in order to guide others to be living their best self. And also the relationships we have with others, due to the way we see them, we're going to treat them a certain way as well. So I want to be a part of helping us understand each other and build relationships.
Interesting. And do you see that as something that a lot of other people struggle with too? That, let's just start with self-perceptions. And do a lot of people wrestle with that?
Yeah, I think it's like a common denominator. I feel like if we are not living our best self, or if we're not going after our, if we're having dreams instead of goals and implementing steps to achieve them, it's coming from somewhere. So it's looking into, well, how are you interpreting yourself? How do you see yourself, or why you aren't going after what you really want in life? And if you keep on having the type of relationships that are destructive, or you're not moving forward, then where is that coming from? And so it's just about looking into and exploring where exactly did these perceptions you have come from to begin with, for why you keep making the choices you make and why you continue to commit certain actions that you commit.
So in my mind, I go to, when we talk about where those perceptions are coming from, I go to social media, I go to families of origin, school. Is that sort of, where are those perceptions coming from that we pick up on?
Yes, and I would also include religion, education, and our experiences.
Interesting. So let's talk about media, because we're exposed to it 24/7 now. How has that sort of changed how we perceive ourselves and others?
Definitely. Yeah. Social media, since we have access, like you said, 24/7 to the news, social media, news feeds, things like that, it definitely does affect us, because people are seeing constantly, we're being bombarded with images and footage of what's happening in the world, and sometimes it can skew our views, because it depends on where you're getting your information from and whose opinions are being told, and they're being told as if they're facts, and what views, what visions, what photos are you seeing, what images are being shown to you that can also be biased. So, I think it's important to pay attention to where you're getting your information, and then doing your own research and seeing, okay, is this credible, is this legitimate, and things like that.
So you take some time to self-reflect, take some time to examine what you're seeing, and then are there ways that you do that? Do you do that with a counselor, with a journal, with your friends? How do you sort of how do you do that reflection that's going to help you evaluate your perceptions and how they're impacting you?
You know, honestly, it's different for everyone. That's why I do these presentations, is to help us actually realize how we perceive things. I mean, I use brain teaser images. We watch hilarious misinterpretation videos. We do activities to help us explore where the source of our perceptions come from. And, I mean, once you do that, then you can start realizing, oh, wow, this is how I perceive. Okay, where did this come from? Start asking yourself why. Why do I think this way? And keep asking why until you get to the answer. And sometimes if you do need to search outside of yourself to get answers, then you can talk to people closest to you. And if you want to see, like, well, how do you see me? But it's still from their interpretation as well. So I think it's best to always look within to just keep asking yourself, well, why? Why do I think this way? Where did this come from? Until you get to the answer.
Right. So that let's expand that out to then how we see other people as well, beyond how we see ourselves, how we see strangers.
Yeah, and that's the thing with how we see others is we have been given these views passed down from generation to generation, and it can have us be divided or help us be able to have a commonality and understand each other. But it's just realizing that these views come from a place, and then what are you going to do with them? And so, yeah, it's just, like I say, it's from recycled perceptions. It comes down from past generations on how we perceive things, and it could be stereotyping. And sometimes these stereotypes, people can feel like they're legitimate because they see so many people acting out and reinforcing these stereotypes. But that's not everybody. It's some people can act out certain stereotypes, but that isn't who they are. There's more to them than that. And that's not the whole group. Not everybody is just like a group of people. So I think it's important to look at people as individuals and get to know them. And don't be afraid to step out and get to meet people and know people who are different from yourself. And I think that's something that would be great to work on with everybody if we could do that so we can start getting along better.
Tell me what kind of feedback you get at these presentations from the audience members. Do they have those sort of mind expanding or aha moments that they come up and tell you afterwards?
You know, I have had people tell me that it has impacted them in a positive way, and it came at a time where they really needed it. I have been getting a lot of positive feedback, which makes me very happy because it's what I want to do. I want to make sure that I'm giving a positive impact in people's lives. And so, yeah, thankfully I have been hearing a lot of positive feedback. And if anyone wants to let me know, oh, you should do this next time, which I've had as someone say, I wish that you kind of like talk to us a little bit more. And I do my presentations different with everybody. I want to cater it to the audience. And so depending on who I'm working with, it's more hands-on or it's a little more, I'll show more videos or whatever. But I've decided to change it a little bit and do more activities with people. So anything anyone says, I always take it and do what I can to make the presentations better each time.
Do you notice differences generationally throughout your presentations? Are some people more open to sort of digging into that work than others?
Definitely. I have noticed with the older generation, and it also depends on too where I'm at, but I have noticed how I've had to do what I can to make sure I point out that I'm not trying to have you see your perceptions as right or wrong, that it's sure. About being more aware of how you perceive so you can see how it's affecting your life. And I've had to do that more with the older generation. And I mean, it's once you have your own understanding of how life works, and you don't want someone coming into you to have you look through a lens that you're not accustomed to or that you don't even want to look through. But it's not about me trying to say, hey, you're doing this wrong. It's just like, let's just look into how we're perceiving and how it's affecting our life.
Well, you can catch up with Halima Yates tonight at 6:30 p.m. Mountain Time. She's presenting Impacting Perspectives as part of the Black Hills State University Rapid City Speaker Series. Halima, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.
You too. If Super Bowl commercials provide a window into American culture, then yesterday's game was about a whole lot more than football. Let's recap the highlights of the Super Bowl ads. Our guest is Bob Colt. He's president and CEO of Colt Communications. He teaches advertising and public relations at Michigan State University. He's joining us now from Lansing. Bob Colt, welcome to In the Moment.
Well, thank you for having me back, actually.
Well, it was quite a game, wasn't it, from the football perspective? I don't think maybe some people didn't pay attention to the commercials because the game was kind of riveting.
Well, you would think that, but actually the research shows that half the number of people, and about 150 million people worldwide watch the Super Bowl, half are watching the game just to see the ads, which is,
really?
You know, why would a 10-year-old girl watch a football game? Well, you know, Lady Gaga is at halftime, or there's this ad about these kids, or, you know, something that they can relate to. And a lot of people watch the game for the ads. And, you know, this the Super Bowl Sunday is like to the advertising industry like Oscar night is to the movie industry. We put on our best show, dress up, and go and show our best stuff. And I think that's what a lot of advertisers did. It was a good game to see. Sometimes we have really bad games, and the commercials are good. Sometimes it's the other way around. But I think this was a winner for both advertising and sports fans.
Let's talk about some of the themes. What did you notice?
Well, you know, there was some socially responsible stuff that you would see or consider in that category. Audi, probably. You've got the Airbnb spot that was faces mixed together. Even the Anheuser-Busch immigration, you know, telling the historical story. All of those could be considered somewhat socially responsible. But, you know, I think the themes are for any Super Bowl, what you really want to do is not get too handcuffed or overwhelmed by being socially responsible. The game itself should be fun. You should have a lot of humor, animation, animals. You put a puppy in a spot and you've got a winner. And, you know, people don't want a whole lot of real serious stuff. That's why our worst ad was actually the American Petroleum Institute. Nobody wants to see big oil in a fun Super Bowl game.
I didn't see a lot of puppies, though. I don't recall a lot of puppies.
Oh, they were all cows.
Were there puppies? And I somehow missed. I went to get a snack during the puppies, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, we recreated Spuds, the mythical ghost dog came back. And so, yeah, you know, I always used to tell people, if you want to have a winning Super Bowl ad, put in a monkey. And one year, we had probably 13 monkeys in different ads. Now the monkeys have dried up a little bit, and people are pressing on with other more exciting things.
All right. So what were some of the highlights? What were the best, most successful ads, do you think?
Well, we thought that the car guys did exceptionally well this year, and that's why we put Honda in first place. You know, you had Ford was in the top 10. You had Kia with some really funny spot. We had the Mercedes AMG spot was really kind of fun, nostalgic for old people. And the Alfa Romeo folks were in the game last year. They had done some Chrysler ads, but this year it was more branding for their Alfa Romeo stuff. And I think that from a visual perspective of showing the product, for the most part, the auto guys did really well. Everybody else, for years, we had always criticized the TurboTax guys. They just did boring, terrible ads. This year, they kind of did a Humpty Dumpty story, and it was cute and animated, and we liked it. It was in the top 10.
So Honda, first place, is this the one with the animated yearbook photos?
Right. And
was that Honda? Okay.
It was, and everybody has a yearbook kind of story, and in this one, we were probably a little biased because Irvin Magic Johnson was in it from one of the yearbooks here in Lansing. So, it was just a fun spot. It ran early in the game and held the lead the entire game, which was kind of unusual. Sometimes the best ads in the game, just for future folks who think about it, they run early in the first quarter. Advertisers don't want to take a chance that, the game will get boring, because we've had some games where there are blowouts, and if you're in the final two-minute break of a real blowout, boring game, nobody is left to watch your $5 million ad.
Right. So how are you measuring it throughout the game then?
Well, what we do is we score the ads in real time using a computer clicker system. All the professors in the Department of Advertising and Public Relations at Michigan State University have the electronic clicker, and we punch in one is the lowest, five is the highest, and anywhere in between based on your expertise. And we automatically, as soon as the ad is over, score the ad, and that's computerized, and we're able to put it on a scale. And, you know, some of these ads in our top 10 were within points of one another. So, really, overall, this was a really good year for advertising.
So I look back to earlier Super Bowls, and this is what I noticed just as a viewer. There were some Super Bowls that I didn't want my daughter to watch the commercials because of how women were portrayed. And I watched yesterday, and I remember thinking, what happened? There's an Audi commercial talking about equal pay, for crying out loud. And even GoDaddy had, which you usually expect, somebody's going to be in a bikini. And they really just didn't have that. So was there a sense of a social shift from what's acceptable during Super Bowl ads regarding portrayals of women?
Well, you know, we might see, as society changes all the time, some socially responsible corporations putting a lot of emphasis even in their advertising, not just speaking out on issues, but making it involved in their advertising. And there is a difference between corporate speech, which is a policy advocated by a corporation, or commercial speech, which is really something that proposes merely a transaction. Well, in America, we can control commercial speech because we don't want bad sugary products sold to kids, and we don't want tobacco on TV. So we really regulate that. But the recent Supreme Court decisions have said, you know, corporations have some free speech rights, and if they want to use their corporate free speech, we're going to let them do it just like any individual would have First Amendment rights.
Let's talk about celebrities. There's a Cam Newton spot, John Malkovich. You mentioned Magic Johnson. How do celebrity appearances play a role, and who were the winners yesterday as far as celebrity spots?
Well, that yearbook ad for right? Honda had several celebrities jammed into one ad. You had Christopher Walken with Justin right. Timberlake paired up. You had Martha Stewart and Snoop Dogg in one ad together. So, you know, we use celebrities because we know them. Maybe we trust them. Maybe we don't. Maybe they're just icons, or maybe they're freaks, and we kind of like a freak show sometimes in advertising. Well, you know, we just use it to communicate messages, and in the end, they should be fun and hopefully funny. And some ads are serious and have a good message. What we didn't see last night, which was kind of unusual, is advertisers for $5 million for the 30 seconds really promoting a sale. No one's saying, hey, come in and buy this product. Well, advertisers have to do that all the time. They have to sell product. But we had a lot more branding, image-oriented, reputation, socially responsible kinds of ads in the game last night.
Were there celebrity ads that scored really well, and were there ones that really missed?
Yeah, you know, obviously
ended up in the bottom.
Yeah, Honda. Yeah. Honda was big. I'm looking. Right? You know, we had the Kia spot with the comedian who was it was just great. T-Mobile had the. Actually, several celebrities,
right.
football players, and you know, we had Mercedes AMG with Peter Fonda.
Right.
You know, some people probably thought he wasn't around anymore, but he reemerged and came out, showed his celebrity status. We had a lot of different celebrities that popped up. Sometimes in Morgan Freeman in Turkish Air. Who would ever predict that Morgan Freeman would be sponsoring Turkish Air and be part of that commercial? But you see him, and it takes a little time to find out who's really doing the ad and what it's all about. And
right.
voila, there's a defining moment in that ad for you.
Yeah. Too controversial. Let's talk about two things here. One is something too political, too controversial, and two, because I want to tie it into this lumber company that said, go online to see the rest of it. It's too political for the Super Bowl. So what about this notion of sending people online to finish a story?
Well, you know, that's a good and realistic expectation if you need and want engagement. But if you noticed, and we watched the entire game, that lumber company wasn't actually in the game. Their spot may have run around it in pregame or halftime. We didn't see it, but all of the professors who watched every ad in the game didn't see that lumber spot. So really, if the audience isn't there in the first place, you're probably using it as an online public relations promotion. And you know, you probably spent a lot of money in production and probably couldn't afford the $5 million for 30 seconds. That ad was probably $15 million, which is why they couldn't, you know, afford to actually place it. You want some engagement from the audience. That's what advertisers really hopefully would like. And hopefully if you touch some emotion, it stirs them, an audience to respond, and is much more effective than just some cognitive kind of information that you would portray.
Was there an ad that you thought was particularly emotional that touched something within you that said, "Oh, that, you know, that got me. That triggered my emotions like a good story should"?
Well, you know, the Audi ad is a good one. I kind of liked, even though it was funny, the Cam Newton. I think any parent watching a football game would say, "Gosh, I can relate to that." For me, I kind of like the well-produced sort of things, or something that I'm going to laugh at. And you know, all of the funny ads, whether it's Skittles or you know, the avocados from Mexico, or any of the other highly scored spots or rated, you know, I kind of want to laugh. At this point, well, advertisers might want to be socially responsible and get in the game. I'm kind of watching the game to tune out of all of that stuff.
And I laughed at that avocado commercial when they were, "You're streaming this." No, it's a secret society. The definition of secret is you're not streaming. I mean, I laughed out loud at that, I have to admit.
Well, and so was avocados from Mexico a socially responsible sort of play and had some, I don't think so. I think they're just selling a product, hopefully, and maybe people tune in because of what we're thinking about in these days.
I also laughed at the Ford. I think it's the Ford commercial where everyone is stuck, and all those you could relate to it. And I'm not sure that every moment of getting unstuck could be attributed to Ford, but everyone getting stuck, you know, in a wetsuit and all these sort of funny, quirky things that humans get stuck doing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, people have. If they can feel part of an ad or made part of it, and everybody has had a bad situation, that's what Ford really linked into. What Ford really did was show some stories in parallel with different shots, and you could sort of see the development of a storytelling ad within the 90 seconds. And then in the end, like Hollywood, we have a happy ending and we have a solution. Oh my gosh, it's Ford. Isn't that great? And you know, the thing about the car ads is that nobody's going to jump up from the game and run down to the car dealer and buy a car. A car is not an impulse buy. It is something that you have to plant a seed, and it could take years before that buy actually occurs and you make a sale. But you've got to do it. You know, sometimes it's difficult, but people will tell you after time, "Yeah, I remember. I just have a good feeling about Ford. They do the right thing. They can help me solve my problems."
Bob Colt is president and CEO of Colt Communications. He teaches advertising public relations at Michigan State University. Bob, this has been fun. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Jessica Mishak is from Deadwood History Incorporated. She joins us for this week's Images of the Past. Today we talk about a Deadwood man who saw into the private lives of his patients, Dr. Frank S. Howe. Jessica, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you so much for having me.
So a physician in Deadwood just sounds inherently interesting. Tell me about Dr. Howe.
Yeah, He was a pretty interesting guy. He came here in 1901 after graduating from medical school in Chicago. And he, when he first came, he kind of apprenticed for another doctor. And the two of them worked in a practice that was over a drugstore, so they had pretty easy access to a lot of the tools and things that they would need and the prescriptions and things. And then the arrangement that they made was... the doctor that was already here and was established had a family, you know, had a wife and children, and so he kind of took care of things during the day. And then Dr. Howe, starting out, handled all the emergent cases in the overnights, and he was responsible for the seedier section of town, pretty much, you know, with all the saloons and the gambling halls and things like
that. Tell me about that first case that he sees, because that's a pretty good story.
It was his first case he saw about a week after he came to town, and it was a woman that worked in a restaurant a couple doors down from the office and the drugstore, and she'd been pretty severely burned with hot water. So he got the call about it and kind of immediately panicked and almost forgot everything that he kind of learned, and rushed down there. And luckily it all came back to him pretty quickly. But he described himself as, you know, the greenest tenderfoot that ever came out west. So.
He's young and he's kind of thrown into it rather immediately. I'm sure lots of young nurses and doctors can relate to that, that moment of panic. So let's talk about this seedier part of town and the saloons and the mining, I suppose, too. What kind of cases does he see?
He saw pretty much everything from stabbings, gunshot wounds. He describes in his autobiography seeing a lot of poisonings and having to deal with those. So pretty much any poison that you can imagine. And he kind of
intentional?
Says, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
He says that, you know, the prostitutes or the women working in the dancing halls, it was pretty typical for them if they got in a fight with their sweethearts that they would take poison. So he was responsible for responding to those.
Really? They would take poison themselves, not poison mm-hmm. their sweethearts?
Yeah, no, they would do it themselves.
So he has this relationship, this professional relationship with prostitutes in the saloons. Then how does that sort of, affect his life in town?
Well, it's pretty interesting. Like, in reading his autobiography, he kind of comes off as a pretty nice guy, pretty conversational. Like, he would come up to you in the street and talk to you, and he describes learning pretty quickly that he wasn't able to do that for those type of patients. You know, no matter how many times he saw one of these women, you know, in a professional setting, you know, answering a call to them or, you know, prescribing them something, if he saw them in the street, then, you know, it was very improper at the time to go up and approach them and say hello. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because he was leading this kind of double life at this time almost, you know, as he developed his practice more and became more established. He also saw the, you know, businessmen and their wives who you can go up to in the street and say hello and, you know, ask how they are. And then he was also responsible for the seedier side of town too. So.
Right. And then he writes about this in his autobiography and puts a lot of it in context. We've got about just a minute left. Jessica, tell me, what do we learn from his autobiography about what kind of person he was and how he changed over his career?
I think, you know, as he, I don't think he ever intended to stay in Deadwood, so he kind of became a family man. He married a woman, a local woman, and then his autobiography is just so interesting in that it describes all these cases that he had that were kind of crazy. He talks about being a country doctor as well, being called out to cases. He interacted with some of the legends that we talk about in the Adams Museum. And it really just kind of shows how he gained confidence as a doctor throughout his time here in Deadwood and wound up spending the rest of his life here. So.
Right. And making a great impact on the community as well. Mm-hmm. Jessica Mishak is from Deadwood History Incorporated. Jessica, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And you can see pictures and the story of Dr. Frank S. Howe on our website, sdpb.org/images of the past.